5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
And they wonder why the common refrain when it comes to politicians is it doesn't matter what side they're on, they're all as bad as one another. Over in Queensland right now, they're gearing up for an election on October 31. And it is set to be scarier than Halloween. While Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk has been copping criticism for months about her handling of COVID, and her deputy Jackie Trad has been at the centre of numerous corruption issues, her opponent over there, the Liberal opposition leader Deb Frecklington, has this morning been referred to the election watchdog in Queensland by her own party due to some questionable events that she's attended throughout the campaign. Meanwhile, down south in New South Wales, Premier Gladys Berejiklian, a self-described goody-two-shoes, the first democratically elected female premier in that state, is under pressure to quit due to a private, close relationship she had for 5 years with a dodgy MP she had to sack just a few years ago. The taped phone conversations that were played to an ICAC inquiry yesterday were deeply uncomfortable to listen to, as he bragged to her about getting commissions from property developers. And as many friends have told me in New South Wales this morning, when you hear the word property, when it comes to parliamentarians and government, you run a mile, because that should have been a red light for her to dump him quicker than a hot potato. Instead, she continued to fraternise with him. Over here, in the Nirvana of Western Australia, Parliament resumes today. And apparently, there are rumours and whispers and innuendo about a leadership coup in the opposition ranks. Seriously, we want to hear your counter-arguments to the budget this week, not squabbling about your own jobs. Coincidentally, I found out today that the WA election next March will fall when Mercury is in retrograde. Jesus, take the wheel. Buckle up, everyone, because I don't think the craziness of 2020 is done with us yet. Now, to much more important, pressing things. Coercive control. Do you know what that is? Well, joining me today will be the CEO of White Ribbon to discuss this fascinating new campaign around this issue of domestic violence. Plus, are you itching to get back to Bali? But what will it be like when we eventually get back there, considering yesterday Prime Minister Scott Morrison basically ruled out us travelling to Europe or the US until 2022? So when do we think that Indonesia may be back on the cards? I'll be joined by Ross Taylor from the Indonesia Institute to discuss that in more detail later. All that and more coming up, so let's get into it.
The West Live. The West Live with Jenna Clark. Brought to you by Neds. Take it to the Neds level. Gamble responsibly. 1-800-858-858.
I'm sure we've heard the phrase, "Why didn't she just leave?" when talking about domestic violence. But what researchers and domestic violence advocates know is that DV doesn't just start with physical violence. Usually there's years of manipulation, mental, emotional, and financial abuse that sometimes escalates to physical violence. The manipulation and isolation from friends and family, the slow but persistent mental beatdowns, are what violence prevention group White Ribbon call coercive control, and they're fighting to make it a criminal offence if seen in a relationship. Joining me now is White Ribbon CEO Brad Chilcott. Brad, thank you so very much for joining me. Firstly, what is coercive control, and is it hard to see when it's happening in a relationship?
Good morning, Jenna. Yeah, coercive control, as your introduction said, is one of the non-physical aspects of family violence or engendered violence. Mm-hmm. It's the surveillance, it's the controlling a person's movements, what they wear, who they associate with. It's limiting access to phone or transport or finances. It's the kind of emotional abuse, humiliation, and all those controlling behaviours that reduce a person's sense of autonomy and independence.
Now, sorry, continue.
I was just going to say, can be hard to detect when, I guess, law and police are at the moment focused on an incident-based response. You know, you need to see an act of physical violence so you can intervene, and that's why we're promoting this campaign to criminalise coercive control so that we can engage with victims and with perpetrators, recognising a pattern of behaviour rather than just a single incident.
You've done some pretty fascinating research. What's that found around coercive control?
Well, we polled Australians around whether they believe that someone would be charged or identified by police if they didn't engage in, you know, a physical act of violence or break a domestic violence order. And 81% of Australians recognised or said, no, that would never be identified. So it kind of shows that Australians know that violence is more than just the physical. 70% of Australians in the same poll said coercive control should be criminalised, and so it shows that they know all this other form of violence that you mentioned earlier goes on for decades.
Mm.
It might never be intervened with. The perpetrators might never be held to account, and the victims might be never taken seriously. Even though many victim survivors say that this form of violence is in fact the worst part of their experience.
And in terms of speaking with the people that can spark change, be that legislators and politicians, what have you had in terms of a conversation with any West Australian politicians around coercive control? I know that our Women's Interest Minister and Attorney General John Quigley, and Women's Interest Minister Simone McGurk are very interested in this field and are looking at certain ways to maybe invoke this in the new Family Law Amendment Bill, which has passed, but they said it is open to tweaks. Have you had any conversations with these type of people around coercive control happening to both men and women in Western Australia?
Yeah, we have spoken, as you mentioned, to the Attorney General and others, and it is true that this is a very complex aspect of law, which is often the initial response from politicians across the board, across the country. It's complex because it is that move from an incident base to a pattern of behaviour. It's also very new in regards to globally. The gold standard for coercive control laws is the Scottish bill, the Scottish legislation,
mm-hmm.
and that only came into place in 2019. And it's showing good signs of making a real difference. With all of that in mind, it is going to take a lot of consultation and careful consideration to construct laws that really work. And so I think politicians are rightly saying, let's take our time on this. For example, the Attorney General in New South Wales today announced a inquiry into coercive control,
mm-hmm.
or the parliamentary inquiry,
mm-hmm.
recognising this will take time to get right, but that these laws are really important to change the way we understand gendered violence in Australia.
See, that's great, and a parliamentary inquiry is a great first step. But one thing that really irks me is that the politicians want to take their time around this. Yet, meanwhile, here in WA last week, in the budget, we had the green light for 800 more police to hit the streets in WA over the next couple of years. Are you hoping that all new cadets in the West Australian Police Force undergo really rigorous DV training, even in regarding coercive control?
Yeah, I think the more that police can understand the nuances and the broadness of what domestic violence constitutes, the better their response will be. And the more they can understand that domestic violence isn't just about the physical incident, but can be this pattern of behaviour, the better the experience of women who are affected by this is going to be as well when they engage with the justice system. But I think, again, this is why careful consideration is needed, because to make a coercive control law work properly, police and judiciary and indeed the public need to be well educated about what coercive control is and that these laws are now in place. Actually, I think this is one of the key powers of making coercive control a criminal offence is that it makes a clear statement about what society thinks is okay and not okay in relationships. And yes, we need the law to hold criminals to account and perpetrators to account, but we also need this public declaration of what is okay in a relationship that you're in, that you can expect a certain level of respect and dignity and to be treated as a human being with individual rights in a relationship that you're in. It, as we start to talk about this and have this conversation, it changes people's perception about what they should expect from any relationship.
Yeah, indeed. I think the first step is definitely a conversation, and getting politicians involved is a fantastic way to spark change and also educate the general public. So Brad Chilcott, CEO of White Ribbon, really excited to see where this campaign goes. Congratulations on the launch yesterday. Thank you so very much for joining us on The West Live.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we speak to one of the selfless nurses who volunteered to go into a COVID-riddled aged care home to help fight the spread over there in Victoria. Plus, your daily news headlines with Sunrise's Matt Tinney. He's back in the studio after a little break yesterday. But first, with Bali and Indonesia in our thoughts yesterday, as we remembered 18 years since 202 people were killed in the Bali bombings, we have to take pause to remember that our island destination of Bali has an immediate crisis on its hands. Bali has the fastest growing death rates from COVID-19 in all of Indonesia. The country has seen more than 337,000 COVID cases and more than 11,000 deaths so far. Joining me now to take us through the situation in WA's northern suburb is the president of the Indonesia Institute, Ross Taylor. Ross, thank you so very much for joining me. Firstly, what's the situation in Bali at the moment?
Yes, hello, Jenna, and all my reports from my colleagues in Bali is, unfortunately, it's extremely quiet, and many more hotels are just closing their doors, and I think that with the COVID cases Bali's now experiencing, I think there's a realisation that it could be an extended period before any significant volume of international tourists get back there.
It's a scary situation. But let's go back to, I guess, 18 years ago. Yesterday, Mark Reddings joined me when he was actually on the ground in 2002 when the bombs went off in Kuta. What have we learnt and achieved as a result of what happened back then?
Yes, I think the significance of the Bali bombing, Jenna, apart from just the absolute devastation to 88 Australians, who died, and but of course their families, that's a lot more people than the 88 that lost their lives. And we also need to remember there was 38 Indonesians. And interestingly enough, too, a lot of people forget, the total of 202 was made up of people from 21 nations. So you can really understand why it had a major effect around the world. Like Mark, I was the West Australian Government Commissioner to Indonesia at that time. I was there about 10 days after the Bali bombing, and it was an eerie, horrible feeling to walk down the streets and just see literally no one there. So it has been devastating, but as you've indicated, I think that even the families of the Bali bombers look to say, well, is there anything good that we can extract from that horrifying experience? So it's a good point that you make.
And I guess COVID, can you really compare the devastation of COVID, the economic devastation of COVID, to what happened back in 2002? And how do you think that will the recovery time take a little bit longer? Because I guess the one thing about a global pandemic is the unknown and the unprecedented times that we're living in, right?
Yes, I think that's a good point, Jenna, is that they're quite, in one respect, they're quite related in terms of the devastation that it's been caused to the economy of Bali. But in another respect, they are somewhat, obviously unrelated. I think what, at least with the Bali bombing, and this is, I'm not trying to sound to minimise the horror of that, but at least, when after the Bali bombing, some actual good came of it, because it was a wake-up call for the Indonesian authorities that they had a major terrorism problem on their hands. And I think it was also a wake-up call, Jenna, to the Australian authorities that thought, look, this is only 3 hours away from Perth. We need to do a lot more to help our friends in Indonesia with terrorism, because if we don't, there is actually a serious risk this is going to come down to Australia. So what we saw was an enduring and remarkable relationship formed between the Australian Federal Police, their Indonesian counterparts, the Indonesian National Police Force, and also, dare I say, our spying agents, the Signals Directorates. And a combination of all this in that 18 years has really allowed the Indonesian government, with the backing of the Australian government, to really almost eradicate, you know, widespread terrorism groups like that were led by Abu Bakar Bashir.
Yeah.
You know, and in that process, they've identified extensive terror attacks that were being planned. So if there's anything that you can take good out of the Bali bombing was that infinitely Bali is now, notwithstanding COVID, a safer place in terms of terrorism for people, but quite frankly, so is Australia.
Yeah, indeed. It was a horrific time, but I guess out of the ashes, we've had seen a formidable relationship forge. Back to COVID, we've spoken many times on the show around the impact that it's going to have on our favourite holiday destination. What are the numbers? In mid-May, we're up around 594 cases, and today, 4 months later, more than 10,000. This is just devastating.
Well, that's the interesting point. I think, as you say, Jenna, in the first really 4 months, February to May, I use the word they struggled to get up to 594 cumulative cases and only four deaths. And really the indication in Bali was that whilst Bali is going to have an economic, a very severe economic downturn, in terms of actual COVID, Bali was managing that very well with only 594 cases and about a 90% recovery rate. So it was very small.
Yeah.
But then, as you've indicated, if you look for the 4 months leading to now, including the decision to reopen the borders to the rest of Indonesia, including Java.
That bloody Java.
As you say, yeah, well, you've seen this 594 in 4 months to the second lot of 4 months move up to 10,228. So it's actually a good example of just how devastating and how quickly COVID-19 can move once infection gets into society. So, and certainly I have to say that has happened since August when the domestic borders were open and about 4,500 to 5,000 people per week were coming in from Java. So and those numbers certainly are trajectorying upwards, and I think that's not looking good for Bali at all at this stage, unfortunately.
Would you be hesitant to put a sort of date on when we Australians may be able to get back to Bali, or is it just too soon to even predict at this point?
Well, in May, you know, I was saying, look, certainly my family and ourselves, we rebooked for May of next year, 2021.
Wow. Yeah.
But when I look at these figures now, and quite rightly, I'm not an expert in COVID-19, but looking at those numbers and look at the border controls we have in Western Australia, quite frankly, I've said to my family, regrettably, I will be delighted and surprised if our family gets back there any time next year.
Wow.
And if I'm proved to be right, and I really hope I'm wrong, the impact on the economy in Bali is going to be immeasurable.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Indonesia Institute President Ross Taylor, thank you so very much for joining me on The West Live. Look forward to catching up with you again soon when we see, I guess, some new stats and some updated travel advice from WA and Australia. You take care. We'll chat to you again soon.
Yep. Always a pleasure, Jenna.
The West Live. Making news.
Matt Tinney from Sunrise.
Good morning, Jenna. Happy Tuesday.
Nice to see you again, my friend.
You too. I've been down on our south coast.
Oh.
Yes.
For work or pleasure?
It was a bit of both. I was down there for a book launch in Esperance. Good friend of mine, Fleur McDonald, who's a very successful WA author. And it was wonderful down there and family enjoyed it. And it's a long way to drive.
Yeah. What, 6 hours?
It's more like eight.
When the kids have to stop for...
Well, no, more like eight normally. When the kids have to stop and you're driving at night, it can take 2 hours more, I found out.
No.
Got there at midnight on Friday.
Oh, you're very, very good. Well, now, what is making news this morning on this Tuesday, this beautiful Tuesday?
Beautiful Tuesday, front page of the paper, cash stash, almost $4 million seized by WA police, biggest cash seizure. This operation also netted 13 kilograms of meth, which is worth $13 million on the street. Where's this money coming from to buy this stuff?
Yeah.
And so this cash, you're probably wondering, where was it found? Police say it was found in two plastic tubs in a truck, which they stopped at Sawyers Valley, which is east of Perth. So police are chasing this up. They believe there's an interstate syndicate that is behind this. Mm-hmm. Two people have been charged over the haul of this cash and drugs, and there are three other people who've been charged with separate drug offences as part of this investigation. So much more to come.
Indeed.
But it's a lot of money inside a plastic tub or two.
I definitely haven't seen, if you haven't seen the front page of the paper today, you know, they look quite clean bills. Can I say, I'm too straighty 180 to say that.
This has only come out now, and I was thinking, it happened last month where they grabbed the cash, and I thought maybe it's taken the police that long to count it all.
Indeed. Now, COVID ships seem to be plaguing our coast, specifically up in Port Hedland. What's the latest up there?
There's a bit of a standoff developing over this COVID-infected ship, the Vega Dream. It's turning into a nightmare. Mm-hmm. It's almost 40 k's off Port Hedland. It's fully loaded with iron ore. Seven people from this ship have tested positive. Six are on board. One was in Port Hedland and has now been brought to quarantine in Perth. Mm-hmm. So we're waiting to see if more people develop this virus on board the ship, or whether the people on the ship become sicker, because then they'll have to be brought back to the mainland, you would think. Now, the complicating thing, the standoff in it all, is that this ship is just outside WA's jurisdiction. So it's technically Commonwealth problem at the moment. But then, you know, if people get sicker on board and have to be brought to WA, it becomes our problem. So watch this one. What we do know that's happened is the big mining companies are now saying that they won't be using Filipino crews on these ships. That's the link between this ship and the previous one, where there was a COVID issue as well. Mm-hmm. So what happened with this ship, the Vega Dream, coming back from China, went to the Philippines, crew change, and this has happened again. So they're trying to avoid it, because it's obviously very costly to have these ships out there and have crew members going backwards and forwards, not only to the companies, but to the state as well.
Indeed. Good news. This is what's been spotted off of Frio this morning.
Blue whale has been spotted off Fremantle, which these are usually in deep, deep water.
Yeah.
We're talking continental shelf.
Yeah.
And this one was less than 2 kilometres off the coast of Fremantle Harbour. Luckily, it didn't go into the harbour. We think what happened was it followed an inbound tanker.
Right.
And so it's come into the coast with this tanker, and then thankfully it's gone back out to sea now, so it hasn't got stuck or anything. But absolutely amazing pictures.
Yeah.
It's not like a humpback. They don't put on quite a show.
They're
they're not the Cirque du Soleil of whales.
They're a bit hefty.
They are. They're a little bit hefty. It looks more like the Loch Ness Monster going in the water. They're that long. But spectacular to see,
Indeed. Well, we'll see more of those images. We saw them on Sunrise. We'll see them on 7 News tonight. Matt Tinney from Sunrise, we'll see you on air tomorrow, and you join us in the West Live after that.
Have a great Tuesday, Jenna.
Thanks, Maddie. Coming up, what reason did an Albany bloke caught driving more than 50 k's over the speed limit give to police? Ben O'Shea will reveal all in the Wild West soon. But now, our next guest is a selfless, brave chick who, instead of staying in the safety and freedom of Perth, decided to head to the front line of the COVID outbreak in Australia and help people in aged care homes in Melbourne during the height of their second wave over there. Nurse Paris Brooks-Pope returned from Melbourne over the weekend and is now in hotel quarantine in Perth, and she joins me now on the West Live. Paris, why did you decide to go over east to help?
Hello, good morning. Well, I thought it'd be a once-in-a-lifetime value experience. You know, it's not so often you get the opportunity to put your hand up to help a frontline during a pandemic.
No, not at all. So tell us about your experience. And so you're a nurse here in Perth, and you went over to help in the aged care system, yes?
Yes, yep.
And so tell us a little bit about your experiences over there.
Yeah, look, I have such admiration for the healthcare staff in Melbourne who've been working tirelessly for the past few months dealing with these outbreaks. working in a COVID positive workplace, every day you're in a gown, a mask, a face shield and gloves, and you have to learn how to smile with your eyes because you're still providing that holistic care to all the residents.
Of course.
Yeah, and tending to all their emotional needs just as much as their physical.
Now, in terms of, there's been a lot of hand-wringing specifically over here around the lack of readily available PPE. Did you have those experiences over there and also when you're at working here in WA as a nurse?
No, absolutely not. We were, yeah, there was boxes and boxes of PPE. We did not run it out at all. Mm-hmm. So we're very safe with all the PPE.
What are you, I guess now that you have returned home, and like you say, once in a lifetime opportunity to experience that over there with a front line of a global pandemic, what are some of the skills that you think you picked up and some of the things that you'll take into work moving forward?
Yeah, being over there, you just had to be so present and conscious of every move you made. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of infection control skills that I picked up being there. And what I can bring home here is just that we all work together with our, you know, strict hand hygiene and health etiquette to keep WA COVID free. We've done so well here.
In terms of when you go back into your everyday job, do you work within the aged care facilities over here?
Yeah, I do. I work at Swancare. I've been there for 6 years.
Lovely. Are you confident that all your workplaces over here can making the right precautions to ensure that if a COVID outbreak does happen again here in Perth, you'll be all healthy and safe in there?
Absolutely. Yep. They're always on top of it. We're always getting emails and about, you know, new learning opportunities, and I'm actually going to sign up for a TAFE course for the COVID direct skill course at TAFE. So a lot of staff are doing that, so we'll be very prepared.
Exactly. What does that involve, Paris?
The TAFE course. So you'll have to go in once a week and do a lot of online learning. So they'll do a lot of PPE training and tell you the procedures and protocols on what to do if there is an outbreak.
Now, how are you feeling? Any fevers, any symptoms of COVID, or you think you've escaped it?
No, I got tested. We got tested very regularly over there. So I got tested every 3 days and all came back negative.
I bet you never want to see a swab again, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got one more left on my 12th day of quarantine and then that's it, hopefully.
Well, Paris, you're an absolute inspiration. Thank you so very much for joining us and looking forward to hearing more from you as your career definitely hits the trajectories over here in WA. You take care.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
The Wild West. Ben O'Shea, how you doing?
Jenna Clark, how are you?
I'm well. I love the fact that we've now got an Albany story for some joker that's been a bit cheeky on the roads.
Yeah, well, cheeky is the word for it. So he was clocked doing 104 kilometres an hour in a 50 kilometre an hour residential zone, which, you know, that's so far over the limit. Like, it's not excusable. It's not 5Ks over.
No.
Like, more than 50Ks over.
I can imagine the cop with the laser gun, it would just have, like, started smoking.
Yeah, no, the smoke coming off it. Exactly. You can picture in one of those American movies, the cops are sitting there eating their donuts and the car zips past and they spill their coffee, the donuts go everywhere. They put the light on top of the roof and away they go. I'm not sure it was like that. But so anyway, so they've pulled over this fellow. He hasn't given chase or anything. He's pulled over. And then they've said, oh, you know, mate, what's the deal? 50Ks over the speed limit. What's your excuse?
There better be someone in labour
exactly.
Or diabetic shock.
Exactly. No, no. He said, look, I was in a bit of a rush to go fishing.
Mate.
Like, there is great fishing in Albany.
It's true.
Like, to be fair, there is some amazing fishing. If the salmon are running, maybe. But you know, that doesn't justify 50Ks over the speed limit.
No.
Like, I don't care how much you like King George Whiting pulling them out of Middleton Beach. No, off the jetty. There's no excuse. The jetty's not going anywhere.
No. So what's fine has he copped?
In the end, I think he's probably quite lucky. Like, he got a $1,200 fine, which is nothing to sneeze at.
No.
And but his license was only disqualified for 6 months, which is, you know, I guess that's what the rules are. But, you know, 50Ks over, I thought you'd almost be in the Hoon Law territory.
Yeah, I thought you were. I thought it was 40K.
Yeah, he must have a good record or something like that. But, yeah, he was in a, you know, like in a Ford Falcon, of course.
Good on you, mate. You absolute turkey.
Yeah, Yeah, so he's a turkey.
Yeah. Now, Jero, back to your... God, we've missed the Jero news over the past couple of weeks.
Oh, well, look, I'm glad I could be back to supply some.
Yes,
and this is interesting for a number of reasons. Uh-huh. Some of it not that funny, but some of it is quite funny. So this fella, he's a grandfather at 43 years old. How is that possible?
It's just nice to be young and sprightly and keep up with
I'm 43 years old. So yes,
you look great, by the way.
Oh, thank you. So if I was in Jero, I'd be a great grandfather by now. Who knows? They start him young up there. But anyway, so this bloke has he was under a police order, like it was a restraining order, and he's tracked down his partner.
Nope.
Because he believed that his partner had stolen his English pound note that had been signed by the English cricket team.
Oh.
Right? So it's like it's a piece of memorabilia. It was given to him by his dad. So he was so sentimental, he reckons, that he tried to track down his partner and she called the cops, as you would. And then he's realised, oh, no, the jig is up here. The cops are on their way. The fuzz is bearing
down on
me.
And in my mind, I've just got the two cops in Albany putting their...
Yeah. They put the light on the road, throwing the half-eaten donut out the window around to this house in Jero. And so he's... climbed into a rubbish bin to hide from the cops, which, look, it hasn't worked very well. I think they just walked over to the wheelie bin, lifted the lid. Hang on, this doesn't look like recycling.
How the Jero cops do not have their own reality show.
Oh, I know.
The amount of bollocks that they have to put up with.
It would be the best of all of those types of police reality, procedural reality TV shows. Anyway, so this 43-year-old granddad has landed in court and the magistrate said, look, bud, like, you know, this restraining order was put down on you, about an hour before you went and did this. So there's not really any excuse for what you did. And so, as I said, unfortunately, going to have to give you a custodial sentence for this because over the last few years you've proven that you don't really do what you're told when it comes to police orders. And so they've thrown him into the bin of the adult bin, which is aka the jail. And so he's going to sit there and at least until January when he becomes eligible for parole. So learning his lesson.
That is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah. His grandkids will have to go and visit him in the Grenoff? Is that the prison up in Jero?
Isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is.
We really need to brush up on this.
We need to brush up on this.
On our jurisdictions.
Half the people we talk about in the Wild West end up in there. So they should be paying us some sort of commission.
Indeed.
Sending us a T-shirt or something.
Indeed. Well, look, the Jero news never fails to disappoint. But again, if you're going to break an AVO, you deserve to be thrown into the bin.
Exactly.
For sure. Ben O'Shea, thank you so very much for joining us in the Wild West. We'll see you tomorrow.
Sure will.
And as we spoke about at the top of the show, if you are experiencing any type of domestic violence situation, please call 1-800-RESPECT or hit up whiteribbon.org.au. But Neds have jumped on board as a proud sponsor of The West Live, and we're ready to take it to the Neds level this spring carnival. If you don't know much about Neds, in a nutshell, it's where betting meets innovation and fun, which makes sense why they have just launched this great new product called Filterform to help you find your perfect match this spring, and it's available across all three racing codes, Thoroughbred, Harness and the Doggies. You can select from your favourite jockey or trainer. You can even select an odds range. This is perfect for someone like me who may want to have a cheeky bet every now and then but doesn't want to study the form guide too deep. Find your perfect match today and take it to the Neds level. But be sure to gamble responsibly. Call 1-800-858-858. That's it from me today. Tune in from 8:45 tomorrow over on thewest.com.au and also on Perth Now. Or a replay of today's show will be on The West at 12:30, or download the podcast. Have a lovely Tuesday. Enjoy the sunshine. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The West Live with Jenna Clark. Brought to you by Neds. Take it to the Neds level. Gamble responsibly. 1-800-858-858. If the story behind the story matters to you, then you can count on thewest.com.au to deliver.